From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And all this week, we're focusing our program on the drug known as fentanyl. It's an opioid, meaning it locks on to parts of the brain, dulls pain, and creates a feeling of euphoria. It's kind of like heroin, but instead of being grown in the ground, it can be made in labs. It's also orders of magnitude more potent than heroin, and thus, even tiny amounts can lead to overdose and death. We're seeing well more than 100,000 Americans dying from overdose every year. In fact, it's the leading cause of death for people between the ages of 18 and 45. Here in Illinois, in our most populous county, Cook, they're still finalizing numbers for last year, but the medical examiner's office expects 90% of overdose deaths to involve fentanyl. The ages of the dead range from an 8-month-old boy in Chicago to a 93-year-old woman in Arlington Heights. Which is why we're going deep on this topic. Today's show is an overview of the fentanyl crisis. Tuesday, we'll talk with people who've experienced addiction themselves and now help others get treatment for this disease. Wednesday, we'll focus on the politics of fentanyl, including competing views on how best to prevent this incredible level of death. Thursday, we'll focus on different solutions people are trying, from what governments are doing with billions of dollars in opioid settlement money to attempts to reach people one by one in hospital emergency rooms. Finally, on Friday, we'll probe how best to talk to our young people about drugs, moving beyond the Just Say No campaigns many of us grew up with. We first broadcast this series back in January. Because of that, we're not taking calls live this week, but you can always let us know what you think about our program by emailing us or leaving a message on our voicemail line, and you can find all the ways to contact us at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. All right. When I thought about who would be the best people to lead off our series on fentanyl, the writer and journalist Sam Quiñones was at the top of my list. He's the author of several books, including two on the opioid crisis. First was Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award for 2015. Then, in 2021, he followed up with The Least of Us, true tales of America and hope in the time of fentanyl and meth. It's a kaleidoscopic book, moving among orderly Belgian pharmaceutical labs, a Mexican prison, and Chinese government conference rooms, all while remaining grounded in the deep pain of countless families across the United States. Sam Quiñones, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you so much for being with us. And I want to begin just by asking you to talk about what's known as the revolution in pain management. That's where a lot of this story begins.
Yeah, great to be with you, Brian. Thank you very much. Yeah, so the fentanyl problem in the country today really has its roots in that opioid revolution and pain management, which is something that began in the mid-90s, really, and promoted by pain specialists, but also then by pharmaceutical companies and doctors that held that we were not doing a good job of treating pain, which we weren't, and that the solution to our pain could be resolved with one tool that we're simply not making a lot of use of, and out of fear that was unnecessary, that there was a fear of addiction, and the tool was the opioids, the various Vicodin, Percocets, then OxyContin, that these were pills that could help us eradicate pain in America. And we were not using them aggressively enough because we feared that the people would get addicted, but that science now showed that people who use these pills, who were prescribed these pills for pain patients, would not get addicted. That's what they said the science showed. The science shows nothing of the kind, really. But that was the way it began. And you began to see an enormous acceptance of people, of doctors, hospitals, pushed by pharmaceutical companies, of prescribing these kinds of pills, really nationwide. Along with that, though, did come a lot of addiction. It did help certain people, there's no doubt about that. But it along with that also came a lot of addiction to these pills, these opioids, and from that then grew the addiction to heroin. Heroin is an opioid itself, a very similar in effect to a lot of these drugs. All of them kind of derive from the opium poppy and so on. And so you what happened then was we created a brand new population of opioid addicted Americans that did really not exist before this. And so by the mid 2000s, we're well on our way to doing that. And then of course the trafficking world in Mexico, which was already providing heroin to the folks who had switched from pain pills to heroin, they figure out that there's such a thing as what they first call synthetic heroin. Mm-hmm. It turns out to be fentanyl. They'd never heard of fentanyl and up to that point. And that's when they really begin to understand how much money they can make, because fentanyl is extraordinarily profitable. Very, very little amounts of it will make you a ton of money. And that's what begins to happen within a few years of their discovery of this.
I want to stick with, so that's phase one, the pills, yeah. the legitimate pharmaceutical pills, often correct. Abused. Phase two is heroin. Phase three is fentanyl. Let's put a pin in fentanyl for now, though. How does someone go from, you know, being a laborer, worked in a factory, maybe had an injury, or an athlete using these pills, to becoming somebody who uses heroin, which is a very different thing?
Yeah, yes. Well, basically, you're prescribed that for whatever injury or pain that you might have had. Could be a sports injury, could be a work injury, could be an accident, a variety of things. Doctor became very, very aggressive about using these pills for all manner of pain. You get prescribed that, and in time, they're highly addictive. Really, we're finding that those pills really ought to be used in very, very limited window for most people. But it was very aggressively prescribed, and then people were given very liberal amounts of refills frequently. And so they become addicted very, very fairly quickly, depending on the person, of course. Some people don't. Some people can't stand the stuff, and some people get nauseated by it. But there's a significant population that does become addicted. At that point, people, a few things can happen. One, the doctor gets very, freaks out and says, what have I done? I've created an addict, cuts the person off. They lose their job, lose their insurance, whatever. There's a variety of things. But what ends up happening is for a lot of folks is that they find themselves without easy access to the pills through doctors. And when that happens, they go to the street. So they're buying it on the street. But those pills were extraordinarily costly, a dollar a milligram. So one 80 milligram pill would be $80. And sometimes people are on 160 milligrams, 200 milligrams, and they can't afford that every day. And so they begin to switch to heroin, which, as I said, is a chemical cousin. They're all opioids. They all affect the same part of the brain. They're all derived essentially from the opium poppy. And so people begin to use that. It's tough to get to heroin, but once you're addicted to an opioid, you find that people say frequently, you know, everything I told myself I'd never do, I did. And so eventually you begin to inject heroin, probably because you already are injecting an OxyContin that you crushed up and mixed with water. So basically you begin to see all across the country, beginning early in the life of these of this opioid revolution and pain management, you begin to see people switch to heroin, but certainly it accelerates. By the mid 2000, 2010, for sure, you're seeing a lot of that, and that just accelerates from there.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. We're speaking with Sam Quiñones, who is the author of multiple books. Two his most recent books are on the opioid crisis in America. The most recent is The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Let's talk about fentanyl. Who was Paul Janssen?
Paul Janssen was one of the great scientific minds of the 20th century, I think. He invented numerous drugs that greatly benefited mankind. He invented fentanyl, which your listeners should know is a magnificent drug when used surgically. In fact, many of your listeners will have had fentanyl, I'm quite sure. I've had it, and after cardiac surgery, I had a heart attack 6 years ago, and it's a magnificent drug. It revolutionized surgery. It replaced Morphine was had a lot of problems with it. One was that it would leave you doped up for hours afterwards. Fentanyl comes in and it takes you into anesthesia, and then it takes you out of it very quickly. All of that happens very, very quickly and easily managed by an anesthesiologist in an operating room. So fentanyl quickly became a workhorse drug in the operating room, particularly when it came to cardiac surgeries and so on. And so it really was of enormous benefit. The reason, and largely it was because of that early quick in, quick out of anesthesia that was so effective and so helpful to doctors. But that's exactly what made it a curse when it came to the underworld, because for users, because very quickly it was discovered by people in the underworld that you could sell this stuff. And this stuff would take people in and out into anesthesia and out, so they or euphoria very quickly, and then they constantly have to be using, making them excellent customers, always have to be buying the stuff all day long. But it has to do really with what makes the drug such a wonderful tool in the surgical setting. But Paul Janssen invented it, and with the idea that he wanted to make an opioid that was not plant-based. This was all pure chemical. And he thought, he knew it was highly, highly addictive, but he thought the addictive problems could be controlled if the supply of fentanyl was also controlled in the surgical, in the operating room. He did not, I think, imagine that it would be made in the enormous quantities that is now being made down in Mexico.
And this is, I mean, this is still used. You mentioned your own medical procedure. That was just back in 2017. You know, I also thought it was fascinating. You write that the first addicts to fentanyl in the U.S. were actually anesthesiologists in the 1970s. Yeah, I wonder what
because,
that says.
Because they did not control sufficiently, according to Paul Janssen, the access to the supplies of fentanyl in the operating room. And so people, I interviewed two for the book, one in particular said, you know, it was so easy to go into the operating room. You just find some fentanyl there, boom, grab a couple. And pretty soon he was addicted. And he eventually had to switch his focus of his medicine. He got out of anesthesiology altogether to be able to get away from the addiction to fentanyl.
When does fentanyl become an illicit street drug, right? One of the first cases you document was in the early 1980s in California. It was known on the street at the time as China White, but it comes and goes away pretty quickly, right?
It does, because it's produced in very, very small quantities by rogue chemists, underground chemists. And once you arrest the guy, or the guy goes to prison for something else, whatever, the supplies just aren't easy to reproduce. The Mexican trafficking world figures out fentanyl in 2005 and 6, when they hire a guy from a Mexican national who had lived most of his life in San Diego, made fentanyl in San Diego, went to prison, learned how to make it better in federal prison in the United States, was deported. They hire him to make a precursor drug to methamphetamine, because by then they're really involved in making a lot of methamphetamine. They want him to make that precursor to methamphetamine. He decides, you know what? No, they don't know what I know, so I'm going to be smarter than, and I'm going to, he makes fentanyl. They get mad, but he explains to them, look, this is the most powerful, profitable drug you're ever going to encounter. And so the first mass die-off really begins in Chicago in 2005 and 6 with the exporting of fentanyl from this lab in Mexico to the street gangs in South Chicago. And you begin to see this fentanyl begin to kill people in record numbers. Among people who are already addicted to heroin. In fact, at first it's marketed as a brand new, more potent form of heroin. Of course, everyone rushes to get it. Lots of people die. And, you know, in the drug world, the opioid addict world, a death is not a warning. A death is an advertisement. Go find that drug. That's really potent stuff. You know, I'm not going to die. That guy died. I'm not going to die. But that's exactly what began to happen in Chicago. It then spread as the sale of those batches went to St. Louis, Detroit, Philadelphia, Camden, various places like that. And then in 2006, that lab that I referred to was busted in Mexico. That guy went to prison, and you begin that die-off simply just abruptly halted. But it showed the trafficking world, particularly the Sinaloa drug cartel, that there was a thing that they could actually make. They have to grow poppies anymore. They could actually make it in a lab, and that this was extraordinarily profitable, and they never forgot fentanyl.
All right, let me reintroduce our conversation. All this week, we're listening back to our series of special programs on fentanyl and the opioid epidemic. We are beginning this week by listening to my interview from January with Sam Quiñones, who is the author of two books on the epidemic. One is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and the other is The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We're going to continue after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we are listening back to our special week of coverage on fentanyl and opioids. We are beginning with author Sam Quiñones, who wrote the books Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic from 2015. And then in 2021, he published The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Our show is on tape this week, so we're not taking calls live, but let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Before the break, we were talking about how this drug was invented and has legitimate medical uses still to this day. That happened back in the late 1950s, 1960s, 70s, 80s. There's a surge of fentanyl deaths in California. It kind of disappears again. Then in the mid-2000s in Chicago, spreading across the Midwest, it comes up again, related to a specific lab in Mexico. There was an individual, the cartels called him El Cerebro, the brain. Ricardo Valdez Torres was his name. He turned the Sinaloa cartel on to the possibilities of fentanyl. They had recruited him to make meth, or help them make meth. Sam, do you think we would have a fentanyl crisis to the degree we do without El Cerebro?
I don't. I think it's possible, because it doesn't take one guy. Many people know about fentanyl. Many people, the trafficking world down in Mexico has a lot of resources and has hired great, university trained, professionally trained chemists to help them. And so eventually somebody was going to tell them how to make this stuff. It just so happened to be this guy for about 9 months in a lab that they provided for him. So I think it could have been easily, that information could easily have been provided to them eventually, particularly given the fact that we had this enormous new booming market of opioid addicted consumers in the United States. And eventually it was just going to be a matter of time, I think, before somebody figured it out.
Let's talk about how is fentanyl different from heroin, right? People hear, oh, it's thousands of times more potent. And maybe we can even mention that fentanyl is sort of an umbrella term now. There are all these other different, very complicated chemical names, you know, some of which are used. You have an example in the book of one of these drugs, I think it was carfentanil, that is used to stop a rhinoceros, right? That is the potency of this drug.
Well, there's a variety of forms of fentanyl. They're fentanyl analogs. They're kind of chemical cousins to each other. And they were all kind of imagined by Paul Janssen in a report that a paper that he wrote. He imagined some 500 forms of fentanyl, just doing different manipulations of the molecule over and over and over. You get to certain of these. Most of them are simply not useful commercially and were never produced. Carfentanil is good for veterinarians, for, as you say, large animals, elephants and rhinoceroses and so on. But fentanyl I mean, to answer the question, you really have to understand too that what's happened with fentanyl is an explosion in supply. So the effect of fentanyl might be much, much more muted had the supply at all, you know, a small fraction of what we were seeing today. The problem is that down in Mexico, they have great access to precursor chemicals to make fentanyl from Chinese chemical companies. They control the shipping ports into Mexico and the Mexico City airport. And so they're able to get just colossal quantities of these precursor chemicals and therefore make the stuff in quantities that really just boggle the mind. And what that means is that affects that has something to do with the effect out there on the street, because eventually what ends up happening with fentanyl, because it's so prevalent, because it's everywhere and it's being mixed now into all kinds of drugs, the tolerance that people achieve is just towering. You're just much higher than anything you're ever able to achieve on heroin, because heroin had to be grown. The poppies had to be grown. It was a much more arduous process. If you have the chemicals to make fentanyl, you can make it all year round, and that's what's happening. And so the quantities are coming in, and you are seeing people's tolerances skyrocket to very. So in down in Tucson, for example, where I was several months ago, users are routinely reporting using 50 to 80 smoking 50 to 80 counterfeit fentanyl-laced pills a day. I mean, it's just a staggering amount. They're not dying because they build up that tolerance very quickly, but it makes it very, very difficult to get off of a drug that you are using 50 to 80 times a day. So it's a lot of the fentanyl is a potent drug. It's true. But a lot of it also has to do with the fact that there is just this colossal supply being made down in Mexico. Very much like the supplies of the pain pills that were prescribed by doctors and provided by pharmaceutical companies. You know, you just saw this huge, huge escalation in pain pills nationwide over 15, 20 year period. Well, that's what you're seeing with fentanyl now, except for the source is different. The source is now Mexican traffickers smuggling it in powder form, but also, as I said, in these counterfeit pills that are coming in now by the tens of millions. You know, those pills started in 2017, roughly, out of Mexico. And you're seeing people smuggle in a couple thousand at a time. Now you're seeing routinely seizures of 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 of these pills at a time. It's just a remarkable explosion of it, but it all has to do with this amazing amount of supply, which has had the effect of effectively covering the entire United States with this drug.
You have this line in the book that anybody can be Pablo Escobar now, right? Because you don't need to spend years cultivating a drug network and dealing with very frightening people with guns and, you know, having farmers in some remote part of the world scratch these drugs from the ground. Anybody can do this. They're using magic bullets in their bathtubs to do very terrible jobs of cutting these really potent chemicals. It's really democratized it in some ways.
I think so. And that's largely, I would say that's really because, well, two factors. One, that they are no longer growing their drugs. There's a radical transformation down in Mexico when the trafficking world down there, which grew up as ranchers and farmers tied to the land, growing marijuana, poppies, what have you. Now those guys have really moved away from that and they're into the synthetic era of drugs, meaning drugs that you make with chemicals you buy on the global market. And that means if you can get those chemicals, you can make, like I said, quantities of these drugs that just boggle the mind. You're seeing it with fentanyl. You are also seeing it now with methamphetamine. The two are kind of hand in glove, really, coming out of Mexico today. But it's because you're seeing quantities now that, used to be, if you sold, like in a certain area, if you sold 20 pounds of meth or heroin or whatever, you would be immediately deemed a kingpin in that area. And now you're seeing many, many people have access to that much. And the price, of course, has collapsed, and therefore the prevalence, it's just this relentless prevalence that's always out there in everybody's face, particularly if you're in the drug world. All of it because of the access to the chemicals, and then the smuggling of all that stuff up to the United States.
And you wrote in The Atlantic recently, and I want to come back to this a little later in the conversation, that prevalence, you think, means we ought to rethink how we are approaching this crisis. Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Sam Quiñones, who's the author of The Least of Us and Dreamland. He has, for more than a decade, been chronicling the opioid crisis in America. I want to talk about some of the social dimensions of addiction and this crisis. You write about the racial aspect of this conversation. And you know, this drug crisis, a lot of people say that it gets more attention because, at least at first, the great majority of its victims were middle-class white people. But you also say that fact is one of the reasons it sort of festered in the darkness, right? And I'm going to read from the book here. They covered up, mortified at how their loved ones had died, afraid to stain their memories. Newspaper obituaries reported that a 27-year-old died of a heart attack. A middle-aged brother died suddenly at home. Say more about how this crisis grew really in darkness.
I think the problem began really with the opioid pain pill problem, because people, it affected, first of all, this was almost entirely a white problem. That was a really rare thing. I don't think we've ever seen a drug problem be only kind of so uniracial. Eventually, it starts out in Appalachia in the Rust Belt, and eventually spreads to, you know, very well-off suburbs, places that have done really well over the last 40 years. And it was there where it met most of its silence, because those families were mortified that their loved ones, their brothers, their husband, their wives and grandparents or whatever, were addicted to this stuff. And that, as I say, the obituaries, kind of really lied about the cause of death and that kind of thing. And so it wasn't until those people began telling their stories. Frankly, it was after my book Dreamland came out, I think, when you began to see people coming out of the shadows to tell their stories about how their son or daughter really died, how many rehabs that person had really been through. And it was when those people began to tell their story that people began to realize the full extent of all this. But it took a long time. It got attention because it was middle class, but it also lacked attention because it was so focused on the middle class, or the white middle class in America, because those folks really didn't want anyone to know. They were mortified. They were very ashamed that this was happening in their family. So they didn't tell anybody. Everybody thought they were alone. Every family with an addicted loved one thought they were all alone. In fact, there was hundreds of thousands of families affected this way.
And that's changing, right? The uniracial nature of this. I mean, I'm looking at the Cook County, Chicago figures for last year. It said 56% of the deaths were African Americans. The opioid taxes.
Fentanyl is the reason for that, because fentanyl, as I said earlier, dealers on the street have figured out that you put a little fentanyl in stuff, it'll boost whatever it is you're selling. So if it's cocaine in the black community, cocaine is the drug of choice frequently among drug users. If you know, you sprinkle a little into cocaine, you'll boost the cocaine. But more importantly, it will very quickly addict that customer. And so that customer may be a casual cocaine user every weekend or every so often. But with fentanyl, there's no such thing as a casual user. It very quickly become a full-time, full-blown addict. And so what you're finding is a lot of the drugs that people are mixing fentanyl into are creating these deaths. And in the black community, for the first time now, in part of the opioid epidemic, you're seeing large numbers of African Americans die of overdoses. What they're really dying of is fentanyl but what they thought they were using was cocaine. Instead, that cocaine has been laced with fentanyl. This is happening in many places, not just in Chicago, of course, but that's kind of one of the things you're seeing, that fentanyl has changed as it spread nationwide.
You even hear, you mentioned this, people lacing fentanyl in other products. I've even heard loose cigarettes, right? People who don't have a lot of money sometimes will buy individual cigarettes. Yeah. It's not legal to do so, but it happens. And there will be fentanyl in that. Why would a drug dealer put something so deadly in something, in these products? Is it really just about creating new markets?
Yes, it's about basically saying, this is a person who will buy from me occasionally. But with fentanyl, as I said earlier, you know, you always have to be using fentanyl because of that quick in, quick out nature of the drug. You always have to be using it. And so you become a very, very daily faithful customer. And then you die because no one lives long on fentanyl. If you either get treatment, you get off the and get off the street, or you die. There's no such thing as really a long-term fentanyl street, fentanyl user in America right now. I don't, and heroin there was, you know, you had find people using 20, 30, 40 years with heroin. You don't find that with fentanyl right now. And so you're seeing people become, it's a customer expansion tool. And even though people die, well, there was so much fentanyl out there that probably you're going to, that customer is going to be replaced by somebody else pretty soon. So you're not seeing a lot of dealers take a great amount of concern with who dies. There, many dealers are also supporting their own habit. So they are really controlled by the drug itself. Again, these are drugs that when you get up into this tolerance, they have complete control of the basic instincts for survival. You know, people, I heard a woman say, a drug counselor say, my clients are really afraid of two things. One is dying from, and depending on the moment, which moment you tend to ask them, one is dying from fentanyl. The other is being away from fentanyl. You know what I mean? It's a drug that is so totally harness their basic instincts for survival that they know they're going to die, and yet they can't stay away from it, and they're terrified of the withdrawals, and so they stay on the street using, even though people come to them and say, hey, we've got a treatment bed, we've got housing, etc. They refuse, and this is going on across the country, seems to me.
Yeah, and you document in that Atlantic piece about how people prefer these tent encampments sometimes because they can more freely use there than they could if they were in some sort of warming shelter. And yet people are dying of exposure now, not just fentanyl.
But it shows you, a tent encampment, and we're in winter now, I think you're going to see this still. We've seen the last several years. You know, you're seeing people, the tent encampments really have become kind of vectors for the use of these two drugs, fentanyl, but as I say, also methamphetamine. And you're seeing that very effect that I just noted, the squelching of the basic instinct for survival by these very potent, very prevalent, cheap drugs. And so you're seeing people stay in tent encampments. Deal duplicitously with loved ones, steal from loved ones, with grandparents, and so on. You see this in addicts of all kinds, but with these drugs, it's just so much more pronounced, it seems. And you're seeing the tent encampments have become kind of like the new Skid Rows, which are that we used to see with alcohol many, many years ago. We're just seeing people whose lives are just basically displays of how drugs thwart or change or squelch the basic instincts for survival that we all possess.
All right, we are going to take another break. When we return, more with Sam Quiñones, the author of The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, and Dreamland, the True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. This is The 21st Show. Please stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. All this week, we're revisiting our series on the opioid epidemic, fentanyl, and heroin and other drugs, OxyContin here in America. We begin with author Sam Quiñones, who wrote the books Dreamland and The Least of Us, deep dives into the situation in America. We first broadcast this series back in January, so we're not taking calls live today, though we did take calls initially during the broadcast. You'll hear from callers during our conversations. If you want to let us know what you think about what we've been talking about this week, you can now email us, talk@21stshow.org. And let's go now to line four, where Ted is calling in from Petersburg. Ted, thanks for calling today.
Hi. I'm calling just with a comment that I personally have a prescription for opioid-type drugs, Norco. But if I were to take it as the doctor prescribes it, I'd be addicted to it. In other words, I only use it when I absolutely need it. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. How are you able to, do you feel like you're ever tempted to take it more often, or does it frighten
you?
No,
not at all. I only use it when I've experienced a fall or a, you know, something that hurts bad. And if it hurts bad enough, I'll go to the Norcos. But I'll try to work my way up to it through, you know, Tylenol, ibuprofen, what have you.
But it sounds like you think you're getting too much opportunity, and maybe other people are as well then.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know how often it isn't easy to get a prescription.
All right, Ted, thank you so much for calling in to share your perspective. I appreciate that. Sam, I wonder if you want to respond to anything Ted had to say there?
I don't really have too much to say to that. No,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Let's talk about your recent piece in the Atlantic magazine. And you've touched on some of this earlier, but you basically say the model we have for addiction treatment today, which is really this idea of forbearance until people raise their hand and say, okay, I'm ready. I need help, right? They hit rock bottom, as the cliche has it. It's well-intentioned, but it's out of date, given these massive supplies of fentanyl and meth and how the modern forms of these drugs work. It's failing everyone, you say. Say more about that. How is this treatment model? Why doesn't it work anymore?
Because these drugs are so prevalent, so cheap, so potent, that they are doing what I just was referring to before the break, which is just controlling people's basic instincts for survival. And so people are refusing treatment. They're staying on the street. The street itself, by the way, is its own killer, with fights and lethal temperatures and all the rest. But these drugs, of course, are doing that as well. They're killing people right and left. The problem is that with these drugs, it has made obsolete certain ideas. And one of them is that you have to be ready for treatment. It's true that eventually you will have to find readiness for treatment if you want it to, if it's to succeed. But how and where that readiness is achieved is a big question. And my contention is that it is not happening on the streets of America today. People are not finding that the drugs are too prevalent. They're getting in the way of that readiness. And so what we need to do is find ways of pulling people off the street to places where they cannot leave, when the drugs are telling them that they must. And that is the more compassionate approach. If you find ways of pulling people off the street, getting them a blessed break from these drugs, then you find ways, then at some point their brains begin to heal and they can begin the process of embracing readiness for treatment. But when they're on the street, that's simply not happening. That the idea that you have to be ready and for treatment, that's the rock bottom today is death. That's the bare facts of it, frankly, on the streets in many parts of this country. And so it feels to me like we need to, in the piece you referred to, I've been writing a lot about jails, how to rethink jail. Jail is becoming, in certain areas anyway, a place where people can go to get recovery, can be arrested detox, get the drug out of their system, and then there's these recovery pods where people can stay for months sometimes while they're dealing with their case and all that kind of thing, to then develop the readiness for recovery. This is a compassionate response, leaving people on the street to say, well, whenever you're ready, just let us know, or we're going to come by endlessly and ask you, and you can keep on saying no, and eventually we hope you'll say yes one day. Those people will die. You do not have the time to develop the readiness before meth drives you mad, basically crazy, and fentanyl kills you. And that's why I think ideas that made sense in another era are now not making sense when the drugs on the street are fentanyl or meth in these profound potencies and enormous quantities that we're seeing nationwide.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, this idea of the harm reduction model, right? Paramedics who are administering Narcan to the same people again and again, sometimes more than once a day, and then those people are just sent back to the tent encampment where they can continue.
And that is a real problem, because not only, first of all, people say, well, we're saving a life. First of all, I don't believe Narcan is, you're saving the life of that person. You postpone that death of that person, perhaps, but it's not entirely clear to me that you have saved that person's life by simply reviving them. The other problem with Narcan, which, by the way, is an essential tool. We need to have Narcan everywhere. We need to have it as commonly as like fire extinguishers in restaurants, that kind of thing, right? It's a very important tool to have, but to rely on it alone eventually means most of those people are going to die. That's that they will eventually use and use and use. And many people you're seeing now have 20, 30, 40 overdoses to their name that they've survived. They've been revived through because of Narcan, but that's not like the long-term solution for those people. Those people need treatment. They need to get off of the street. The other problem with relying on reviving people out of overdose, once they overdose revive, is that every time you overdose on an opioid, it's a deprivation of oxygen to the brain. So eventually what you see eventually with people is after they've overdosed numerous times, you begin to see a significant brain impairment, inability to follow conversations, inability to focus, that kind of thing, because they've had so much oxygen to their brain, deprived of so much oxygen over and over and over and over. And then frequently it can be, as you say, the same day or a day later. Brains require time to heal. And that is where the NFL is showing that. That's why they put people in those concussion protocols. When the insult of injury to the brain, it needs time to heal. The same is true of opioid overdoses. People need time to heal. But the problem is on the street, they're not getting that time, because the idea is, well, you know, one day you'll tell us that you want treatment, but it's not going to be today. Okay, fine. Well, that person, in the context and the environment of unrelenting supplies of fentanyl and meth, that person's going to die unless that person gets off the street. And I believe jail in this context, in this world that we now face of prevalent supplies of methamphetamine and fentanyl, jail is a place where we could put people where they cannot leave, where they can get that blessed recovery and respite from the dope, because otherwise on the street, fentanyl and meth are going to kill them.
I think we have a caller on the line who has a question about supply. Chris is calling from Urbana on line one. Chris, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know who is getting arrested for bringing the drug fentanyl from the Mexican cartel labs over the border to the U.S. Because, as you probably know, fentanyl has become a reason to hate Latino immigrants.
Yeah, it certainly is a talking point you hear on the right. Thank you for that question, Chris.
And I would say it's important to understand about drugs coming in from Mexico. This is a major issue that Mexico has simply not dealt with. Okay. And I lived in Mexico for 10 years. My first two books were about Mexico. I know it fairly well as a country. And I can tell you that right now, Mexico is simply not dealing with the issue of, first of all, precursor chemicals coming in from China into those ports, being used then to make the quantities of chemicals, and then of course the drugs that are being smuggled. We are not dealing with this through our own, in our own way, because we have allowed for the sale, widespread sale of assault weapons, and those assault weapons, or many of them, are being smuggled down to Mexico. Those same people who are making these drugs are using those weapons to ensure the impunity, their own impunity, to be able to make those drugs. It's important, however, to understand that most of the drugs coming into the United States do not come in on people. They're not strapped to the body of a person or on a backpack. They are coming in trucks. We have free trade with Mexico. There are millions of cars and vehicles, I should say, not just trucks, vehicles coming back and forth all day long, all year round. You're talking about millions of vehicles. We simply do not, will never have the manpower to be able to check even more than a small percentage of those vehicles. And that is how you explain nationwide supplies of fentanyl and methamphetamine, supplies of meth in New Hampshire and Maine, as well as Oklahoma, as well as California and Seattle and so on. You don't get there in backpacks. You don't get there as strapping these drugs. It's not that we shouldn't care about people coming in with counterfeit pills containing fentanyl on their person. Or inside their bodies, that's frequently the case. But the major supply is coming in trucks and cars. And I believe one of the main reasons that that's possible is because the Mexican government has done very, very little, and has shown very little interest right now with the current president in collaborating with the United States on this. And so you're getting kind of a blind eye turned to this whole problem down in Mexico, on the part of the current president of Mexico, anyway.
The current president of Mexico, yeah, to specify. You know, we only have a couple of minutes left in our conversation, and I do want to touch on one last point. It's right there in the subtitle of your book, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. What gives you hope right now?
I don't
feel a lot of it.
Yes, that is there's a whole long conversation we probably need to have about that. There is, in my opinion, and we don't have time for that. I hate to tell you, probably going to have to come back and hit on that topic in another time, because this is a complicated thing. And it actually happens to be more than half of the book that I just, we've been talking about fentanyl and methamphetamine to some degree, the topics of my last book, but the hopeful parts of it really are more than half of the book. It's just that what I find to be the case is that this, what we're seeing, particularly at the small town level, is you are seeing small efforts beginning to bear fruit, not necessarily in drug interdiction, but in a development, strengthening, rebuilding of community. And that can be, I've got a story coming out soon, and I'll be happy to send it to you, about small towns in eastern Kentucky, where they were rebuilding their economies, not based on some big Walmart or some shopping center or a coal mine or a factory, but on the smallest little micro-entrepreneurial endeavors of the local folks, all of this supported by local folks. And so you're seeing at the very local level a rebound, a glimmers of recovery that are so exciting and so fascinating to watch. I believe that's what makes this whole epidemic it's calling on us to rethink how we've been doing things. And I think at the local level, that's where it's most important. You're finding people responding in ways to thinking of how to best strengthen, rebuild, repair the communities that we have allowed to be shredded for decades now.
Yeah. Sam Quiñones, this has been a fascinating conversation. I hope to have you back to have that more hopeful conversation sometime in the future. Thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me, Brian. Thanks for the great questions. And I'm happy to return to talk about that other part anytime you wish.
The books are The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, and Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. We're going to continue this conversation all week here on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Stephanie Mosqueda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.